Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Research shows that childhood adversity has short and long-term consequences on physical and behavioral health. Not only does the stress from adversity impact health in childhood, it puts people at greater risk for heart disease, cancer, and other chronic diseases later in life. That's the bad news. The good news is there are ways to help children heal from adverse experiences, put them at lower risk for chronic disease later in life, and even to break the generational cycle that could put future children at risk. Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris is a pediatrician and the founder and CEO of the Center for Wellness. She's pioneering efforts to determine how toxic stress impacts children and how to identify and treat children before lasting damage is done. Her new book is The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity. And she joins us from our studios at WGBH in Boston. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Now, you started your medical career as a pediatrician in an economically disadvantaged area of San Francisco. So what were some of the persistent health-related issues you saw in your patients?
When I finished my residency training and I started a clinic in this Bayview Hunters Point, which is a very low-income area of San Francisco, what I noticed was a really disturbing trend. Over and over again, I was seeing kids being referred to me for very high rates of behavioral problems. And folks would say, you know, this child has ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Please, could you put this child on Ritalin? But what I also noticed was that these patients, as well as other patients who had things like asthma or eczema, skin inflammation, or even autoimmune disease, where the immune system attacks the body, the patients who were the worst off had the worst histories of childhood adversity.
So you started the Bayview Clinic, and your work seemed fairly straightforward, giving people great care, make it easy for them to get it affordably, and watch this population of kids get healthier. And although it sounds like a formula that's been repeated in many communities, it wasn't always working, as you're saying. So you have this aha moment when you have this patient, Diego. Tell us about him.
Diego was a 7-year-old boy who came to see me, and he was referred for ADHD. And when his mom brought him in, I noticed as I did his exam that he had more things going on than just behavioral problems. He also had asthma. He also had eczema. And he also was really little. He was itty bitty. In fact, even though he was 7 years old, his height was average for a 4-year-old.
So you did this test to sort of determine what his adversity might be. So tell us about the conversations you had with his mom.
Yeah, so this was actually before I started routinely screening for adverse childhood experiences in my practice. And in this case, I was just trying to figure out what was going on with his symptoms. And so I asked mom, you know, can you tell me more about these behavioral problems that he's been having? You know, when did they start? Did you notice if there was anything that might have precipitated them? And she became tearful. And what she told me was that his behavioral problems started after he had experienced a sexual assault. Mm.
So walk us through what happens in our brains when we're exposed to stress.
When we are exposed to adversity or stress or any scary situation, what kicks in our bodies is something called our fight or flight response. Our bodies release high doses of stress hormones, including adrenaline and cortisol. And these hormones were designed to save our lives from a mortal threat. They do things like raise our heart rate, increase our blood pressure and our blood sugar, which allow us to mobilize energy and oxygen and resources so that we can either fight that threat, right? If it's a bear in the woods, you know, fight that bear or run from the bear. And that's a really good thing. The one thing, a couple things also happen that are less obvious. which is that the part of our brain that's responsible for judgment, executive functioning, impulse control, that gets turned down. Because if you're fighting a bear in the woods, you actually don't want to be thinking about what your odds are of winning. Right. You just want to be reacting. And the less obvious thing also is that when your body activates your stress response, it also activates your immune response. Because if that bear gets his claws into you, you actually want your immune system to be primed to bring inflammation to stabilize the wound. And all of those are designed to be life-saving. Mm.
Human biology is intricate, and it works, as you're saying, amazingly well when things are in balance. But the hormones released when we experience stress can throw that balance way off if it's happening not moderately, but all the time. So explain that sort of ripple effect.
Well, when our stress response system is activated too intensely or too frequently, it goes from being adaptive or life-saving to being health-damaging. And this hormonal response is activated over and over and over and over again, and it ultimately leads to long-term changes in our stress response and overactivity of this fight or flight response. Mm.
And you also mentioned something really important was the immune system and inflammation. And we know that inflammation is at the basis of many chronic diseases and situations.
That's right. And in fact, individuals that have been exposed to high doses of adversity in childhood, and especially in childhood, because children's developing brains and bodies are extremely susceptible to high doses of adversity, what we see is increased risk of diseases like heart disease, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, even things like arthritis or autoimmune disease, where the immune system attacks itself.
And it turns out you were not the first person to recognize the link between adversity and illness. So tell us some more about the study initiated by Drs. Felitti and Ande, and they looked at how childhood experiences impacted health.
Yes. Yeah, so when I saw this trend in my patients, I really wanted to dive into the research and the science to understand how this happens. And what I came across was a groundbreaking study called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study that was done by the CDC and Kaiser Permanente. And in this study, these two researchers, Dr. Vince Felitti and Dr. Robert Onda, asked 17,500 adults about their histories of 10 categories of adversities in childhood. And these include physical, emotional, and sexual abuse, physical and emotional neglect, or growing up in a household where a parent was mentally ill, substance dependent, incarcerated, where there was parental separation or divorce, or domestic violence.
67% of the people scored at least one on this test. And when you look at these adverse childhood experiences, the scores, the higher the score, the greater the health risk, right?
That's exactly right.
And these things you're mentioning, I'm thinking, is there a family that doesn't have at least one of those? I mean, we're talking about a lot of kids here, right?
A tremendous number, yes. In fact, right now there are approximately 35 million children in the United States of America that have been exposed to adverse childhood experiences.
And this study was not done in low-income areas. Turns out that anyone, regardless of income level or ethnic background, can score high on this we call ACE list score. So explain why this is so important from a public health perspective.
Adverse childhood experiences increase our risk, right? And not a little bit. I'm talking about a dramatic increase in our risk for 7 out of 10 of the leading causes of death in the United States. And when we are thinking about the fact that we as a nation spend almost $3 trillion a year on healthcare, if we are not addressing adverse childhood experiences as a root cause of chronic disease, then we are missing a huge opportunity. But on top of the healthcare costs, when we think about the impact of adverse childhood experiences on a child's ability to learn, on our ability to successfully hold down a job, on our risk of becoming dependent on substances. An individual with four or more ACEs is 10 times as likely to be an IV drug user. And as we think about a nation that's currently in the throes of an opioid crisis, we really need to think about how do we address some of the root causes instead of putting a Band-Aid on the downstream effects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you give an example about a well. You say if 100 people drink from this well and 98 get cholera, you can write a prescription and fix those 98, but you're not looking at the well. What's the root of the problem?
That's right. Yeah, we need to go to the source.
Children are, as you're mentioning, particularly vulnerable to stress because of their developing brains. So what are some of the critical and sensitive periods of brain development, and how can stress impact that development?
So critical and sensitive periods refer to times where there is heightened neuroplasticity in brain development, the ability of one brain cell to connect to another brain cell. And these levels are particularly high during the prenatal period, during the first 5 years, and particularly the first 100 days. But there are also windows of enhanced neuroplasticity that happen during the adolescent period as a result of the hormonal effects, as well as during pregnancy and the immediate postpartum period. And these windows represent opportunities for us to take advantage of biology to get enhanced effects from our interventions.
So what are some of the different ways that you see stress manifest itself in children?
So one of the most obvious ways that stress manifests in kids is behavioral. And I think that's the thing that we're most familiar with, it most consistently meets our expectations. So we see kids who have poor impulse control, difficulty paying attention. They may be, quick to get upset, or the opposite. They may be withdrawn. They may seem vacant or absent. And these are a lot of the symptoms that educators and other members of the community were referring me kids thinking that they had ADHD or attention deficit. In our research, we found that when we looked at 700 children in our study, if they had an ACE score of 4 or more, they were 32.6 times as likely to have behavioral and learning problems as our patients with 0 ACEs.
Mm. You know, we think of kids as, really resilient and able to bounce back, and that's true to a point. There are protective factors that buffer children against stress and help them bounce back. What are some of the most important protective factors to adverse experiences?
The definition of toxic stress is this body's response to adversity, this overactivity of the stress response in absence of a buffering caregiver. Safe, stable, and nurturing relationships and environments are critical for reversing or buffering the effects of an overactive stress response. And just as we can activate each other's stress responses, as humans, we biologically have the capacity to buffer each other's stress response.
You screen your patients for adverse childhood experiences as part of their regular exams. So how is that information used to create treatment plans, and how do you collaborate with other caregivers?
We do this in a couple of different ways, and I talk a little bit about this in The Deepest Well, in the example that I talk about one of my patients, Lila. Lila was a 3-year-old girl who came to see me, and she had failure to thrive. She wasn't growing well, and her previous pediatrician had been giving her nutritional supplementation, right? Extra calories. But when her mom came to see me and said, she's not growing, what should I do? I also had one additional piece of information, which was her ACE score, which we routinely do at our center. And her ACE score was 7.
Wow. Yeah.
That means she had 7 out of 10 of these adverse childhood experiences. And so we supplemented her care with child-parent psychotherapy, which helped her mom understand, number one, how to reduce the dose of adversity for her daughter, and number two, how to be a healthy buffer by managing her own stress and her own stress response so that she could biologically buffer her daughter's stress response.
And it worked.
Yes. Yes. Well, that's the exciting thing, is that when we actually know what the mechanism is, when we know what the problem is, then we can actually be more effective with our interventions, and they're more likely to work. And in this case, with Lila, within 6 months, she was back on the growth curve. Mm.
You mentioned we've seen a rise in the diagnosis of ADHD in children over the past two decades. Are there examples of children that you screened for adverse childhood experiences and treated whose ADHD symptoms decreased or disappeared without medication?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, right now in kind of standard pediatric practice, medication and particularly stimulants are really the mainstay of treatment for attention deficit. But again, understanding the science is so critical, because if the problem is an underactive attentive function, then absolutely it makes sense to give a stimulant. But if the problem is an overactive stress response, then that's a situation where a stimulant may not help, and in some cases, it might make things worse. Mm. And so we focus our interventions on reducing the dose of adversity, enhancing the buffering capacity of the caregiver, and doing interventions that help to regulate the stress response, things like mindfulness. In our practice, we do something called neurofeedback, which allows the patient to be able to activate the part of their nervous system that counterbalances the fight-or-flight response, called the parasympathetic nervous system. And so all of these interventions are part of a more targeted way to address the same symptoms, but more effectively.
Mm. There's strong scientific evidence linking adverse childhood adversity with chronic illness, and we know it impacts everyone, regardless, as said, as socioeconomics, gender, and ethnicity. It seems pretty clear that we have a great opportunity if screening for ACEs became standard practice, but not everyone agrees. So what are some of the concerns people have raised, and how do you respond?
You know, some folks are concerned about the idea of, you know, whether these questions are too invasive. I think many of my colleagues are concerned about not having adequate resources. How do we screen when we, you know, we don't have a therapist in our office, you know, we can barely get access to a social worker? And these are things that are all completely understandable in terms of concerns. At the same time, we have to understand that we will never get these resources unless we demonstrate the demand. Mm-hmm. And what we are seeing, and in fact, the original researchers, when they screened a population of 110,000 patients at Kaiser with this ACE screen, and these were adult patients, what they found was actually better healthcare utilization. Within the following year, they saw dramatic decline in emergency room visits and better utilization of doctor's office visits in patients who had been screened by ACEs. Mm.
Children are routinely screened for a number of risk factors and illnesses as part of well visits. So what would it take to make screening children for adverse childhood experiences standard protocol?
Political will. So certainly, I mean, there's a huge impact of we need the training, folks need the tools. And that's something that my center, the Center for Youth Wellness in San Francisco, has been addressing. We created something called the National Pediatric Practice Community on ACE screening. And for any practitioner, any pediatric practitioner, or primary care practitioner, who wants to be part of a community that's learning how to screen for ACEs, they can just go to nppcaces.org and join our National Pediatric Practice Community. But we also need the will, because, you know, as my colleagues say, you know, there's no reimbursement for it. Right now we need, you know, the systems and the supports for clinicians to be able to do this. And so, you know, for anyone who would like to see this happening, even, you know, talk to your doctor and say, hey, do you know about the ACE study? Are you screening for this? And if not, would you like to learn, right? Would you be willing to learn along with me?
Mm. And there may be healthcare professionals listening now thinking, this makes sense, but how could I possibly make the time, as you're saying, to go through an adverse childhood experience screening, unpack all that with my patients? So describe how your ACE screening questionnaire has evolved and how some of the issues brought up in the questionnaire are dealt with.
The ACE screening tool that we developed at the Center for Youth Wellness helps to take some of the challenges of screening off the table. What we do is actually called a de-identified screen, which means when we list the 10 traditional adverse childhood experiences, we actually don't ask our patients to tell us which ones, only how many. Hmm. And that allows primary care doctors to do their jobs, what they're supposed to do, which is identify risk. It allows a patient to be able to give us this information without having to say, yes, my child was sexually assaulted. Yes, my child, her dad was incarcerated. But rather to say, you know, my child has experienced three of these or none of these or eight of these. And as a doctor, then my next step is to connect that patient to the right resources.
Mm. And, you know, I'm wondering, too, sometimes we may not realize what is stressing our kids. I'm thinking, I can't remember which patient it was where you talked about. You're trying to figure out when her symptoms started or happened, and it was when her dad punches the wall.
Yes, that's right. I was caring for a 10-year-old girl with severe asthma, and I was trying to understand what her asthma triggers were. And as I sat down with her mom to walk through, could it be pet dander or pollen or dust? I said, have you noticed when it is that your daughter's asthma tends to get triggered? And this woman said to me, you know, doctora, I noticed that my daughter's asthma tends to act up every time her dad punches a hole in the wall.
Mm. And what about words? You know, I'm wondering sometimes, kids can feel stressed with some of the language we use and maybe not. And I don't think a lot of times, you know, parents are intentionally trying to create stress for their kids, but they may be unaware of the stress that they are creating. So how do you create that awareness within the household?
Well, one of the wonderful things about routine screening for adverse childhood experiences is that it's both a screening tool and also an educational tool. Mm-hmm. It's just a moment that's part of the physical exam that allows us as doctors also to be able to counsel patients, you know, when kids are exposed to, these experiences, that it activates their stress response and it can harm their health. And verbal abuse or verbal violence or emotional abuse is also part of those exposures that can cause these health problems in kids.
Mm. So what role should schools and educators play in the issue of identifying toxic stress and creating safe and healthy environments for children?
One of the most important roles that educators can play is really, number one, recognizing the symptoms of toxic stress when they are manifest in the classroom. Because currently, for educational environments where folks are not trained, many folks are responding to symptoms of toxic stress. For example, if a child is having difficulty with impulse control or emotional regulation, with reactive and punitive measures that only further activate the child's stress response. Mm-hmm. And this is where understanding the science makes such a difference. And programs like Turnaround for Children in New York or the Center for Wellness and Achievement in Education in San Francisco are implementing science-based interventions to improve educational environments.
Mm. I can't remember if this was in the book or in an interview I read that you did where you talked about the stress that teachers have trying to address this. And I think you gave the example of if you had a classroom full of kids with epilepsy, having epileptic seizures, you can't teach it. It's impossible to do. And we sort of have that in some classrooms now where most of the class, these kids are having behavioral issues. And we should be saying, we can't do this. We have to do something. Again, back to that root of what's the cause, you know, the well with the cholera.
That's exactly right. In fact, I think that the problem is a miscategorization of the problem. Of course, we expect teachers to deal with some behavioral issues, but this is a biological issue, and it is unfair to expect a teacher to stand in the front of a class where half or two-thirds of the kids have an overactive stress response, have high levels of adrenaline and cortisol, and expect them to get the lesson done, mm-hmm. right? That's right. Just unfair. Yeah.
You got married and became a parent while you've been working on this issue. Did becoming a mother give you different insight into the issue of childhood toxic stress?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you know, one of the things about becoming a parent for me was that a much deeper understanding of the intricacies and the messiness of, you know, family systems. I think that, you know, one of the hard things about toxic stress, when you think about the antidote being a buffering caregiver, is that oftentimes the stressor for the child is also an incredible stressor for the parent. Mm-hmm. And one of the things the science taught me was the importance of self-care, really helping to make sure that my own stress response is well-regulated and under control mm-hmm. so that I can be there for my kids.
Yeah. It's when I was thinking of a parent who has a number of children, and, you know, she says you get overwhelmed, especially when you have four, but this woman had 10, and she would say she would go into the bathroom and scream. And she said, it's amazing how they calm down when you come out of the bathroom.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, one of the points that I try to make in the deepest well is that self-care is not selfish. We need to put our own oxygen masks on first, because if we are not well, if we are not balanced and well-regulated, our entire family cues off of that energy.
Mm. Now, let's take the instance of parents, you know, where you talked about the opioid crisis, and we have parents who maybe both are, you know, victims of substance abuse, and they may not be able to, you know, properly de-stress the environment for their kids. What do you do in a situation like that? We have many grandparents, not only here on Cape Cod, but a lot of grandparents across the country raising grandchildren, or, you know, trying to help those grandchildren be in a better, safe environment. That's a tricky situation, and I'm sure you run into it in your practice.
That's right. And to those parents, I really want to say, you have to reach out for help. Get help. And part of that may be your village, if it's a friend, if it's a neighbor, if it is someone in your faith community that can help support you and be that safe, stable, nurturing environment for your child when you're not able to do that. And this is part of the reason why every segment of our society needs to understand and be responsive to the impacts of adverse childhood experiences. So, and if you don't have that village, right? So maybe it's talking to your doctor and reaching out for resources at a doctor's office or a community center, or seeing what resources your child's school may have.
Mm. Then the other children I really feel for are some of the kids in the foster care system who, you know, through no fault of their own, may be in a good foster home, may not, may have to move from home to home, different schools. And then, of course, they reach that age of adulthood and they're sort of on their own. There really isn't anybody, once they get to 22, really looking out for them. What advice do you give for those kids?
Yeah, I mean, by definition of being in foster care, it means that you have experienced some significant trauma. One of the first things that I want to say for these young people is, number one, healing is possible. Mm-hmm. And in the deepest well, I talk a little bit about some of the interventions, things like mindfulness, things like regular exercise, things like nutrition, and making sure that you have that village, that you find those sources of support that can be a buffer to you during those difficult times. But it's also recognizing that because of what you've experienced, your body may make more stress hormones than the average person, and that can look and feel like being quick to anger or having difficulty controlling your impulses or getting sick easily when you feel overwhelmed. And just recognizing that that's your body trying to protect you. And, you know, mm-hmm. that was necessary at one time, but you know, hopefully you're in a place where it's no longer necessary and you can figure out a way to calm down that stress response.
So could adults benefit from these screenings as well as children?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, that is what we saw happened with Dr. Vincent Felitti and his patients at Kaiser. His patients benefited greatly. And when I speak to Dr. Felitti, one of the things he tells me is that his patients benefited from him just asking. In fact, he had many, many, many letters of thanks. When he originally did the ACE study, the hospital was worried that he would, you know, be triggering, you know, traumatic memories, and that it would be awful for patients. And he was required to wear a pager 24/7, 365 for 3 years when he was doing the study. And that pager never went off with a patient in crisis. Rather, what happened was that he got dozens, hundreds of letters of thanks. One from a woman who said, "Thank you so much for asking. I thought I would die and no one would ever ask."
You open the book with, I think he was a middle-aged man who's having a stroke. And when they get to the emergency room and they're asking all the risk factors, the childhood adversity that he suffered was not, in, you know, wasn't known, I guess, to his wife at the time. And this is another area that you can become, your risk factor can go up for if you have those higher scores. So if you learn this as an adult, that you had a score of 7 or whatever it might be, above 4, can that be reversed as an adult? I mean, we're talking about ways to, you know, kind of break that cycle with children. But when you're an adult, can you still reverse that?
So in adults, it's certainly more difficult, but there is a lot that can be done to improve health risk. So yes, we can improve health outcomes in adults. And in that particular situation with Evan, who has a stroke at the beginning of the book, they actually, in the emergency room, they never asked about adverse childhood experiences. And that was kind of the point. They said, oh, he's got no risk factors because he doesn't smoke and he doesn't have diabetes and he doesn't have, you know, high blood pressure or any of the traditional risk factors for stroke. But they never asked about adverse childhood experiences. And that is the point, because when you find out that an individual has high ACEs, then as a doctor, what you can do is counsel them and say, okay, let us work on your diet. Let us work on your nutrition. Let's work on getting your stress response. First of all, assessing, you know, is your stress response overactive? And if it is, let's work on ways of mitigating that overactive stress response.
And you talk about the fact that, you know, you're one doctor. You can't solve the problem alone. This is, you know, got to be, it's much bigger. And, you know, one teacher or one school isn't going to solve this with one program. Everybody kind of has to get on board. So are you optimistic that with the research and the results that we're seeing, that this will become more widespread?
I'm incredibly optimistic. And the reason for that is because, you know, let's face it, childhood adversity has been going on since God was a boy.
That's
like,
right,
this
yeah.
is not new stuff. What is new is the past several decades worth of science that gives us the tools to develop better strategies and interventions. You can't solve a problem if you don't know what the problem is.
Diego, who inspired your aha moment linking toxic stress to health, remains a patient of yours. So how is he doing today?
So he is doing well. He's up and down, right? The thing that's really exciting to me is that Diego and his mom know that when something happens, when something goes on in his life, something stressful or something challenging, and listen, Diego lives in the neighborhood in San Francisco with the highest homicide rate in the city. So there are things that go on all the time, and we recognize that he has an overactive stress response. But when something happens, he knows to come in for a tune-up, right? Mm-hmm. And because I see him as part of his regular medical care, and I check in with him over the last 10 years, we know the protocol and when we need to start it again. Mm.
So what message would you like to send to parents about toxic stress in children?
I think one of the most important messages is, number one, that this is not about blame or shame or any of the above. This is just basic biology. And we need to be able to recognize this problem in order to be able to address it. And the second thing I would say to parents is we need advocates. This health threat will not, we won't have the resources we need to solve this problem without public will. So I just want to tell all of the parents, the practitioners, the teachers, the educators out there, get active, become an advocate, and be part of the solution.
Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris is a pediatrician and founder and CEO of the Center for Wellness. Her new book is The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity. We'll have a link with more information about her book and her work at our website, capeandislands.org. Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks to Tom Devlin and Doug Shugarts for production assistance in Boston.
You're listening to The Point. In this next piece, Karen Brown looks at an emerging field of science, looking at how trauma embeds itself in the brain and body and who weathers it best.
He just likes to complain, and then if you put him back down, then he's gonna meow again.
Sophie and Jessica are fraternal twins with a soft spot for needy cats. They're sitting on a couch at their mother's Eastern Massachusetts home, snuggling up to one of their feline adoptees.
All our pets were strays. So, you know, they kind of had to figure out, like, skills to survive and stuff.
These quiet teenagers are glad to be talking about their scrappy animals instead of what my interview is supposed to be about, how they cope with stress and trauma. Their parents have been in an acrimonious custody battle since they were preschoolers, and the girls have spent years in therapy trying to make peace with their estranged father. At the time of our interview, they were going through a court-mandated reconciliation process, which they hated and feared, and they were uncertain about where they would end up living.
I think about this whole, I call it the dad situation, I think about it a lot, like every single day. And sometimes if I try and push it down for too long, it just kind of comes up and I literally just burst into tears wherever I am, and like I can't stop and I feel so stressed out.
Sophie has tried to create psychological walls to compartmentalize the stress so she can live as normally as possible. She rarely succeeds. Her sister Jessica seems to have an easier time with this strategy.
I think I'm probably a little tougher, and I don't really get sad. I go straight to being angry and mad at everyone and not exactly nice, so I don't really think it's a good thing. But, like, it's kind of like I put up a wall. So I'm probably a little tougher and colder than I should be.
These girls are remarkably self-aware for young teenagers. They admire each other's, albeit imperfect, method for weathering stress and worry, for being resilient. And that's where their lives intersect with emerging science. Sophie, in particular, is fascinated by how her brain works and what neuroscientists can learn from it.
Hey, Sophie, how's it going in there? Good. You are doing a fantastic job. You're already one quarter of the way through the task.
Dr. McLaughlin recruited 60 adolescent subjects for her brain imaging study. Half of them, including Sophie, reported surviving trauma. The other half was the control group.
Okay, you're doing a great job. We're just getting ready to load up the memory task. So we'll be back with you in just one second, okay?
McLaughlin expects to find a difference in how the two groups do on cognitive and emotional tasks, and she'll compare what their brains and nervous systems are doing at the time. Sophie, for instance, took a battery of artificially frustrating tests while hooked up to neural sensors.
It's like there was this video game one that I had to do. When I pressed the right answer, it said it was wrong, and I take my video games very seriously, so I got very, very upset, and I was like, what is going on?
While Sophie was getting stressed out, McLaughlin's research team noted which parts of her brain were more active and how fast or regular her heart rate was. Without divulging Sophie's particular results, McLaughlin, who's now at the University of Washington, did make some general findings. One, that the prefrontal cortex, just behind the forehead, functions differently in children who've been traumatized, especially if a task involves both cognitive and emotional components. She's also found heightened activity in the amygdala, an emotional center of the brain, during emotional tasks.
They see the same picture as kids who haven't been exposed to trauma, and they just have a much stronger emotional reaction to it. So kids who are traumatized may be just less able, in terms of how their brain functions, to sort of dampen that initial emotional reactivity.
So here are our guys.
Psychologist Stephen Sumi introduces me to the hairy subjects of his long-running study on trauma and resilience.
These are rhesus monkeys.
They live on the sprawling rural Maryland campus of the National Institute of Child and Maternal Health.
These are four-year-olds, so they're like teenagers, and they're about to get fed right now, which is why everybody's making so much noise.
Sumi studies the interplay of genes and the environment. His team observes monkeys in different early experiences, some reared by their mothers and others taken away from their mothers and reared by other monkeys in a nursery. Over time, the researchers take blood, saliva, and hair samples to determine the monkey's genetic makeup and to measure how much of the stress hormone cortisol builds up in their system. They line up the various environmental and biological factors and stack them up against the monkey's personalities as adults.
What we have found is that early experience is really important. And what happens to you socially in the first couple of years of life, if you're a human, or the first 6 months of life, if you're a monkey, will affect just about everything, behaviorally and biologically.
As he explains this phenomenon, we walk by a few cages of monkeys and witness one of them become agitated and lash out at another.
It was the start of what could have been a fight. But the monkeys, the well-socialized ones, know how to stop fights before they really get out of hand. There are some monkeys who would not back down, and then you get a fight, and those are the monkeys with low serotonin.
Serotonin is a brain chemical connected to pleasure. The serotonin transporter gene determines how efficiently that chemical is delivered. Each gene has two alleles, and those can be some combination of long or short versions. Sumi and other researchers have suggested that monkeys and humans who have two short alleles show an interesting behavior. They appear to be more sensitive to both bad experiences and good experiences. That means some young people are more likely to be psychologically harmed from a stressful environment. But when put in a nurturing environment, those same people are most likely to thrive. Sumi sees this in his monkeys, depending on if they're raised in a nursery or with their mother.
If you have the short version of the gene and you grow up in the nursery, you tend to have higher levels of aggression when you get older. Monkeys getting into fights and being excessively impulsive. If you have that same short version of the gene, but you grow up with a good mother, you show less aggression than normal.
Lately, Sumi has also been excited by the notion that while we are all born with a set group of genes, the way they are expressed can be affected by our experiences or environment. For instance, what a mother ate while pregnant, or how children were treated or mistreated early in development. That's called epigenetics, and it's one of the fastest developing areas in biology.
We used to think you inherited genes, you were stuck with them, and then you had to live with the consequences. And we now know you can change not the genes, but the way they work.
This can be both good and bad. Scientists following survivors of the Dutch famine of World War II have attributed some of their later health problems, and those of their descendants, to epigenetic changes from severe hunger. But Sumi says there's also evidence that genes can change back, even long after trauma. He leads us to a bigger cage of small monkeys, who at first are terrified of me, and later move closer and seem cautiously curious. Sumi says his researchers have brought into this group an older monkey couple, as sort of foster grandparents meant to give social support.
The old female will provide comfort to those infants that are a little scared or need some cuddling. And the males, the old male, breaks up fights, keeps the peace. And that's the kind of manipulation that we've already found that changes lots of genes or normalizes lots of gene expression.
Sumi says this concept could also explain why some people who've gone through trauma feel a lot better after certain activities.
So things like yoga, meditation, things like exercise, even in people your age and mine, can change the way your brain is wired and can change the way your brain works and can improve your health.
Do you want me to get the tzatziki and you get the mozzarella? Can I have some?
Yeah. Like the monkey research, there's continuing science on how to build resilience in children before and after traumatic events. Many books and papers have come out in the past decade on factors that give young people strength to cope. Chief among them, healthy social connections. Something that Sophie and Jessica seem to have intuited on their own.
Oh, can we have extra slices of bread for the tzatziki?
Thank you.
A few times a week, they come to this neighborhood diner with their good friend Maggie to eat Greek food and talk about life.
We had to like write this thing about like who's a mockingbird in the book and like what does a mockingbird represent.
Today, they're brainstorming paper topics on the classic book To Kill a Mockingbird. To hear them chatting, these girls seem well put together and emotionally stable.
I loved it.
I liked it.
I thought it was really good.
I liked it a lot.
But in fact, on this day, they're anxiously waiting for a judge's order on whether they have to leave their mother's house to live in a boarding school. The uncertainty has been overwhelming, they say.
It's very stressful to, like, think about it. And then, like, on top of, like, schoolwork, because I have, like, 5 million projects. And
I can usually, like, put it away during school and just not think about it. Although then it usually comes out, and I have these awful nightmare stress dreams. And then I'll wake up, and I'm, like, crying, and I have to, like, call my grandmother or, like, hug a cat.
So is there a genetic profile or a brain structure that makes some more likely to cope well with life's challenges? Is it congenital optimism and intelligence, as some psychologists say, social supports, or a combination of many small factors, as research increasingly shows? Harvard professor Charles Nelson.
At the end of the day, you scratch your head and say, so now what do I do with this? All you've done is say, these are the components of the resilient person.
In other words, does understanding the mechanisms of resilience do more than just inform academia and lead to actual relief? Rebecca Elliott thinks yes.
If we understand what makes someone resilient, potentially we can use that to help us think about better treatments for depression, potentially preventative treatments. You know, perhaps there's a point, you know, much earlier where we can get involved with people and help them develop resilience, if you like.
Whether resilience is innate or actually can be developed is up for debate. So is the notion that neuroscience can improve upon existing therapies for past trauma. In fact, research out of Columbia University suggests that natural resilience without any intervention is much more common than previously thought. I've wondered whether any of the new brain research will help Sophie and Jessica get through their adolescence unscathed, though it's heartening to see how many resilient traits they seem to already possess. Jessica, for one, recognizes their strength in numbers.
We're lucky that we have each other that we can lean on and we can protect each other.
Sophie has decided she wants to be a brain scientist when she grows up, her way of constructing meaning out of the pain she's gone through, which is another sign of resilience. But for the most part, these girls have relied on a homegrown trial-and-error approach to coping, one that Sophie is willing to impart on other young people going through hard experiences.
If they really need to just cry, then they should, because they need to let it out. But then even if they're the type of person that likes to be alone, they should try to surround themselves with the things that they love and the people that they love so that they can start to heal. You know, to just try and be as strong as possible, even if that's the hardest thing in the entire world to do sometimes.
That piece was produced by Karen Brown. I'm Amy Vince, in for Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.